The second case for oral argument this morning is Wolf versus Sensed. For the appellants, I understand Mr. Schaefer, you'll be making the argument this morning? All right. And for the appellee, Westfall, there'll be a five-minute presentation by Mr. Tobin, but that will go second. And then Mr. McKnight, you will be, you're representing Sensed and Bulge, and you'll be speaking for 15 minutes. All right. Justice Meyer-Henny has disqualified herself, and the court has appointed to sit in her stead the Honorable Arthur Rush, the presiding judge of the First Judicial Circuit. Mr. Schaefer, you may proceed, sir.
Please, the court, counsel. My name is Mike Schaefer. It's my privilege to represent Myra and Arnie Wolf in these consolidated appeals. These appeals raise essentially two issues. The first issue is whether or not the trial court erred in determining that Mr. Sensed and Mr. Bulge had sovereign immunity because their functions were discretionary as opposed to ministerial. And the second issue is whether the trial court abused its discretion in refusing to consolidate these two cases for appeal. The two cases that are on appeal, first case is Catherine and Joanna Westfall versus Myra Wolf. Myra Wolf, in turn, has a third-party complaint against Mr. Sensed, Mr. Bulge, Kirk Preheim, and Preheim Landscape. The second case is Arnold Wolf on behalf of himself individually and on behalf of the estate of his son Landon against Sensed, Bulge, and Preheim with a third-party complaint against Myra Wolf. An additional party in the Westfall case is Farmers Insurance Group under an uninsured motorist claim. And the facts of the case are this. This case arises out of a car accident that happened on January 21 of 2000 on Highway 42 east of Sioux Falls. At the time of the accident, Catherine Westfall and her daughter were in a car traveling east into Sioux Falls at 7:30 in the morning, going somewhere between
west into Sioux Falls,
going between 42 and 45 miles an hour. Myra Wolf was traveling east to take her son Landon, who was 11 at the time, to Brandon to school for him. He had to make up some work at school, traveling east. And this stretch of road, there's a curve and a hill where this accident happened. And shortly before Mrs. Wolf's vehicle collided with the Westfall vehicle, there was another unknown car, phantom car, nobody can identify who it was, that fishtailed in front of the Wolf vehicle. Mrs. Wolf then lost control, slid broadside into the Westfall vehicle, killing her son Landon, who was a passenger, and causing serious injuries to her, closed head injuries. She was in a coma for a month in the hospital. This all arises out of a snowstorm. The road conditions all arise out of a snowstorm that occurred 2 days before on January 19th. It began about 4 in the morning. It started out as rain. It turned to snow. At the time of this, during this time frame, and actually for about 5 years before, the state of South Dakota, the Department of Transportation, had contracted with Mr. Preheim and his landscape business to do winter maintenance on this stretch of Highway 42 from the east edge of Sioux Falls to the Iowa border and Highway 11 up to Garrettson and down south toward Canton. It's the only contract in the state where a private contractor was charged with the complete snow removal, ice control, sanding of a stretch of state highway. And this was a priority one road. Now, at the time, Preheim's people had problems with their equipment. It actually broke down the morning of the storm, was out of commission for several hours. The snow became packed, snow-packed and icy in that stretch of road. The day before this accident, on the 20th, the next day, a fireman and an emergency medical technician from Split Rock Township called Jeff Sands and said, listen, this is a terrible stretch of road. You better get somebody out here and do something or somebody's going to get killed. I mean, it's the only case we've ever seen where somebody actually predicted something like that and had complained to Sands before about the maintenance of this stretch of road. That night, the night before this accident, between 7:30 and 9:30 that night, Warren McClain was driving on that stretch of road, said there was no sand on it. He slid out and started to spin out and lose control at the same spot and said it was the worst stretch of road in this whole area at the time. The following morning, Tim Nicolai, who was also a firefighter and emergency medical technician for Split Rock Township, who happened to be called back to the accident, but on his way to work, he spun out there at that same spot, said there wasn't any sand on this road. It wasn't sanded. And the undisputed facts are that Preheim never used any magnesium chloride or calcium chloride. It was referred to in both fashions, but it's the same thing, apparently, until after this accident occurred.
Now, you got to tell me about that, because I'm not sure I understand the record. Did or did not?
Did not.
No, the policy. I want to get to the policy.
Okay.
Did the policy specifically require the addition of those chemicals on that day or the day before?
Well,
the temperature considerations, was there discretion there or was it mandatory?
Your Honor, in all fairness, I think there probably is some discretion there, and that's where I'm getting to the point. The policy required sanding of that stretch of road beginning at 5 in the morning.
I understand that issue, and I'm sure we'll talk about that later.
But the section of the policy that precedes that said that the region engineer had discretion concerning the sequence, the rates, and limits of work. In the policy, the sequence refers to the priorities, the interstate, the ramps, the priority one, the non-priority. It's all determined as sequence. The rates, the only thing that can refer to is the amount of salt and de-icer that could be used in these materials that they use. And the limits of work refers to the amount, the only thing it can refer to is the amount of the material that would be put down on a given stretch of road per mile or whatever. First of all, that's what the trial court, I think, hung its hat on to say that there was discretion here. And therefore, Bolte and Sense were entitled to immunity because it was a discretionary function. But that provision comes ahead of the provision that requires sanding to begin at 5 in the morning. And what happened here was the night before, Mr. Bolte's testimony is the night before it was sanded out at 8 o'clock, 7:30 or 8 o'clock, thereabouts, and he basically told Preheim, don't even come back until 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, which was an absolute violation of the policy concerning sanding. And, I mean, I know Mr. Bolte and Mr. Sense's lawyer is going to stand up here and argue, well, they had discretion. Well, the fact of the matter is, Merv Bolte had never even seen the contract and claims to have never seen these standards before his deposition was taken. So I don't know what discretion he claims to have been exercising at that point.
But in some circumstances, wouldn't it have been wise to go out and to start sanding and scraping and cleaning it off once the morning traffic has gone by, into work and whatever?
Actually, no, because these folks admitted that traffic can, even if, I mean, there's a big dispute as to whether they put sand down the night before, because the affidavits we submitted said there wasn't any sand on this stretch of road. Obviously, that's a fact question, I think, for a jury to decide. But the fact of the matter is they all admitted that the sand can blow off with traffic. So even if they put it down, it can be gone. And the purpose of the policy to have people out there at 5 in the morning sanding is to ensure that the roads are safe for travel when all this traffic comes in the morning, because there's like 6,000 vehicles a day that use this stretch of road to come into Sioux Falls. And I think Mrs. Westfall said it's basically bumper to bumper in the morning at that time. So basically what they did is they just absolutely ignored what their own policy said as far as when they had to be out there and when they had to sand. Now, I think the case is very easily decided based on this court's previous precedent in Bryant.
You think that you're entitled as a matter of law to a ruling that there was no discretion in sanding at 5 o'clock?
Yes, I do.
And for what case do you rely on?
Well, basically I rely on the case of Bryant versus Butte County, where this court held that the maintenance of secondary roads clearly falls within the ministerial category.
Is this a secondary road?
This is a primary road.
I thought.
And Butte County was secondary and involved county roads. But what's the distinction between a county road where the court said we're not, and they applied the seven factors of Lear, of the National Bank versus Lear, and in the Kylo case, and said the Butte County commissioners were performing a ministerial function as far as maintenance of the secondary roads. Here, it's a ministerial function.
There is a statute that says the county shall maintain the highways under its jurisdiction. Is there a similar statute pointing at the DOT?
There is, Your Honor, and I think we cited it in our brief. I can't put my hands on it right now, but there is a similar statute that governs the DOT. But the point that the court made in the Butte County case was the concern the court has is, are we trenching on the executive or legislative function? And the court says, no, we're not, because the legislature enacted a statute that required them to do that. Here, not only is there a statute, but the DOT adopted its own policy. We're not talking about the adoption of the policy concerning road maintenance. We're just talking about the enforcement of it.
Are you asking to go to the jury on any claim other than failure to follow the policy? In other words, failure to inspect or some of the
other. I think the failure to inspect is also part of it, because under the contract.
But that's not in the policy.
In the contract,
okay,
there is a duty by the maintenance supervisor to supervise the contract.
Is that contract binding on the state?
Yeah, the state entered into the contract.
Aren't we getting quite a ways down the chain here, though? We've got a private contract between somebody in DOT and a private contractor. Who sets the standards to determine if it's ministerial or discretionary? Isn't that the legislature or the transportation board?
No, Your Honor, I think the Department of Transportation sets the standards. And I think if the question here was, are we going to decide whether the standards were appropriate or not, that very well might fall within the discretionary function exemption. In other words, the Secretary of the Department of Transportation or the higher-ups in the department. But here, they adopted the standard. The Department of Transportation adopted the standard that required the sanding during this early morning hours, and all we're asking for is to enforce the standard. I mean, this is a far cry from the Hansen case, where the lawsuit was brought against the Secretary of the Department of Transportation and all of the commissioners of the Department of Transportation. And the court here was concerned, these are people that are dealing with high-level policy decisions and functions that are charged with essentially all the state highways in the state of South Dakota in a $200-some million budget or whatever it was. That's not this case. This is a case where we're dealing with a maintenance supervisor who's really one step removed from the guy that's in the truck that's sanding and blading. And, I mean, to suggest that's discretionary, I mean, every decision or every function has some literal discretion, but this court has never held that makes it a discretionary function.
What about the fact that the 5 a.m. policy was subject to the traffic moving safely exception?
Well, it was subject to two exceptions: traffic moving safely and being too hazardous. And there's no evidence to support the claim that the traffic, I mean, obviously the traffic wasn't moving safely at 5 in the morning, and it wasn't like somebody went out at 5 and checked it and said, okay, you don't need to do it. It's just like Mr. Bolci said, you don't even need to come out until 8 o'clock.
Whether the traffic is moving safely or not would seem to implicate a discretionary call. The question is here, it seems to me there's a clear dispute of fact because of the affidavits, whether the sanding was adequate. Now, tell me your view on the law. Assuming that there is such a dispute of fact, does this court make that decision on the discretionary versus ministerial decision, or should a jury make that decision?
Well, I know the case law says that whether it's discretionary or ministerial is a legal question for the court to decide.
But the twist here is we have a clear dispute of fact about this exception because of the affidavits you've submitted.
And in Brown Eyes, I think the court said that if there are factual disputes, they have to be resolved, that go to this issue, they have to be resolved in favor of the non-moving party. And the trial judge here resolved all of the factual disputes the other way. I mean, he basically said it was all sanded out. It's undisputed, I think he said, that the crews plowed, sanded, and re-sanded the road in question. And our position is, based on these affidavits of these independent people, is that, wait a minute, there is a serious dispute about whether it was sanded out, even the night before.
Mr. Schaefer, you mentioned about the failure to inspect and the timing. What about your claim about the failure to make sure there was insurance?
I think that's another part of it. That comes back to Mr. Sense, because his supervisor, Mr. Weep, testified that Mr. Sense had responsibility to ensure that there was insurance in this case. And that's also one of the factors that the courts look at for whether it's discretionary or ministerial. It's the seventh factor. It says the availability to the injured party of other remedies and other forms of relief. Here, Preheim was required to have $1 million worth of liability insurance, and the Department of Transportation was supposed to receive notice of any cancellation. There was no notice given. It lapsed.
Is that in the contract?
Yes. It's in the contract, and Mr. Weak said that was Mr. Sense's responsibility to ensure that that insurance was in place.
So are you alleging then that the state's insurance, the people insurance, would have to step in and cover?
Well, the suit against the Mr. Sense and Mr. Bolci is covered by the People Fund. And so they are covered by the People Fund. My point is, under that seventh factor, we don't really have the questionable availability of a remedy from Preheim, who's now uninsured and who was required to have under the...
But is that really a legal cause of what occurred here? I mean, it seems to me a stretch to say that failure to have somebody get insurance is going to determine whether or not it's a discretionary or ministerial function, or even whether it's a legal cause of what occurred here.
Well, I'm just saying that that's one of the seven factors that the court looks at. In other words, is there a remedy for the injured party? And there may not be one in this case. But that's something the court gets to take into consideration in determining whether it's a ministerial or discretionary function.
You've only got 2.5 minutes left. Would you, and your opposition argues that the real prejudice would be is if the case were consolidated to have inconsistent verdicts. Tell me about that.
That's our position. If it's not consolidated, there will be potentially inconsistent verdicts. And the reason is this. In the case of Westfall versus Myra Woolf versus...
So what damage would... I mean, what unfair prejudice would result from that? So what if the verdicts are inconsistent?
Well, the same issues of liability... The issues concerning liability and apportionment of fault should be the same in both cases involving Mr. Preheim, Mr. Sense, Mr. Bolci, and Myra Woolf, who are alleged to be the culpable parties. Now, if those are the same, and the Westfall case is tried before the Arnold Woolf case, which has all those same parties in it, the first jury could apportion fault in one fashion and the second jury in another. And you've got, based on the same evidence, you've got inconsistent.
And I'm saying, so what? I mean, what's the unfair prejudice in that? You've got a chance to argue about it. You've got a chance to fight about it. If you come back with inconsistent verdicts, so what?
Well, I think one of the cases that we cited, one of the federal decisions, said that that's one of the reasons why you should consolidate cases, is because of the potential of inconsistent litigation, inconsistent results. And And that's a very, that's something that could easily happen. Now, I think what the trial judge did is said he thought that there was prejudice to the Westfalls because the Land and Wolf wrongful death claim would get interjected into this whole equation and it would be unfair to the Westfalls. But it's no different than any case where there's cross claims, counter claims involving an accident where people arising out of the same accident where people have claims against one another.
But you acknowledge the potential for prejudice. I mean, you've got an alleged tortfeasor whose child died in the accident. I mean, I could see.
I don't think that's a potential for unfair prejudice because it arises out of the entire transaction. Myra Wolf in the Westfall case has her own claim for however many hundred thousands of dollars in medical bills. Her loss of being in a coma and her closed head injury is part of the Westfall claim anyway, because she has that claim for contribution and that claim against Mr. Sense, Mr. Bulci, and Mr. Preheim in that in the Westfall lawsuit.
Thank you. Your time has expired. Mr. McKnight, you have 15 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mike McKnight, and our office represents Jeff Sense and Mervyn Bulci in these two appeals. Mr. Sense is an employee at the South Dakota Department of Transportation and is the area engineer in the Sioux Falls area. I think the record reflects that he really has basically an administrative type role, really little no hands-on function in snow removal. Rather, that's delegated to Mr. Bulci, who is.
What about his obligations in regard to the insurance?
By contract, he did, Your Honor, but I would tend to agree with Judge Zinner. I don't know if that is something that would create any liability here. It's not really a cause of action. My understanding of the record is that there was a certificate of insurance provided initially, and it simply lapsed kind of midway through the contract term.
But the certificate of insurance showed that it expired prior to the end of the contract term. Am I correct in that?
I did not interpret it that way, Your Honor. I thought that it expired midway. There had been a certificate provided saying, yes, he is covered and expired midway. And I seriously don't think that creates a cause of action anyway. What we're talking about here and what Mr. Schaefer has talked about here is snow removal and whether or not the snow removal was proper. Mr. Bulci is the highway maintenance supervisor for this particular area, and he's the one that's responsible for that. And he's got responsibility for about 300 miles worth of roads, that area that Mr. Schaefer described as part of it. But it's a significant amount of roads in the Sioux Falls area. Judge Severson, of course, granted summary judgment to my clients, Mr. Sense and Mr. Bulci, on the grounds of sovereign immunity. He concluded that both Mr. Sense and Mr. Bulci were acting in a discretionary capacity and thus immune from suit. Whether or not an action is discretionary or ministerial is a question of law, and this court reviews the record de novo.
Let's back up for just a minute and go back to that insurance question again. If the company failed to give the notice to the people that were on the policy as a named insured, and the substantial judgment is recovered against those people, wouldn't they be subordinated to the claim? Wouldn't whoever recovered the substantial judgment, wouldn't they somehow be subordinated to present that claim against that company for failure to give notice? Because presumably you would have put the policy back into force and effect.
I think potentially, Your Honor, and I think the record reflects that Mr. Preheim is considering whether or not there would be some action to take against his company directly for not providing the proper notice. But again, I don't think this case turns on whether or not Mr. Preheim had insurance or didn't have insurance insofar as
it's a secondary matter, I agree. Was Preheim given notice that his insurance policy lapsed? Not the state?
I believe Mr. Preheim, as I understand it from his deposition, Mr. Preheim was aware that the premium was due. I think there had been some contacts with the carrier to see if they would extend or let him buy some time. That didn't happen, it did lapse, and that's really an issue I think that Mr. Preheim has to address at some point, and I don't think has any bearing on the liability of Mr. Sense and Mr. Bulci in this particular case.
Okay, why don't you move back to whether or not the actions of these two individuals was
absolutely
protected under the policy whether they were involved in government policy making.
Absolutely. And I think Mr. Schaefer looks at this kind of like a chocolate chip cookie recipe. In other words, you add 4 cups of flour and 2 cups of this and 3 cups of that, and you make your cookie. And it's not quite as simple as that. Snow removal is definitely, and I don't think anybody can disagree, I mean, it is a task that does require some discretion, judgment, or skill. And this court has said many times when dealing with this issue that a ministerial act is an act that involves obedience to instructions and demands no special discretion, judgment, or skill. Clearly, it's our position that winter snow removal does demand that kind of a special discretion, judgment, or skill. And we would submit that it's not only a literal discretion that's been discussed in the briefs, but it's rather a policy-making discretion. And the policy...
What about this policy that Mr. Schaefer referred to that he claims mandatorily required sanding at certain times?
I don't interpret it that way, Your Honor. First of all, let's focus on, if we could, paragraph number 3 of that sanding policy, policy 2531. And that's the provision that says, changes in the sequence, rates, or limits of work as stated in this standard may be permitted by the region engineer or his authorized representative. Now, clearly the standard that's referred to is that entire section. That's policy section 2531 that deals with sanding.
But wait a minute, before you go any further, Tom Week was the area engineer.
He was the region engineer.
I thought he was the area engineer.
No, Mr. Senst is the area engineer.
Excuse me.
Senst reports to Mr. Week.
And that policy only applies to the regional engineer, correct?
By the region engineer or his authorized representative, which I would submit to you as a matter of law, would be Mr. Senst. I mean, that is who Mr. Senst reports to in the chain of command.
Did Mr. Senst have any position in relation to his underling, Mr. Bulci, in this case? I mean, do we have any evidence of any further instructions or of any input that he gave to him?
The chain of command was, in simple terms, as relevant here. Mr. Week was the region engineer. Mr. Senst was the area engineer. Mr. Bulci was the highway maintenance, or one of the highway maintenance supervisors,
right,
in this area.
Is there any evidence of any input from Senst to Bulci?
With regard to this particular storm, I don't believe so. But my understanding is that Mr. Senst instructions to Mr. Bulci is, you know, the snow removal is your thing. You know, you're the one that calls out people to remove snow when you feel that it's necessary, which was done in this particular case.
So he delegated any responsibility he had to
Mr. Bulci.
Huh? Can he do that?
I think he can, Your Honor. I think he can.
Under a policy like that?
Sure. Sure, I believe that he can.
Is there a record that Mr. Weeks delegated his responsibility in this to Mr. Senst, which is what the policy calls for?
I don't believe there's any evidence in the record that Mr. Weeks delegated this to Mr. Senst, but I think as a matter of law, when he's the underling, he's delegated that, and Mr. Senst would be his authorized representative.
What law are you referring to?
Well, I'm not sure I can point you to anything in particular, Your Honor, but it just makes common sense. I mean, Mr. Week is not going to be the person that's going to be responsible for snow removal throughout the entire state. That's why we have this hierarchy of people that are in charge. And you have Mr. Week as the region engineer, Mr. Senst Mr. Senst is the area engineer, and then below that, the highway maintenance supervisors.
And why doesn't their policy say that the area engineer has to make this decision instead of saying the regional engineer has to make it?
I can't answer that, Your Honor. I mean, that's the policy is what the policy is. It talks about changes in the sequence, rates, or limits of work. I would submit to you that limits of work is more broad than Mr. Schaefer has said. I think that deals with the hours that you're going to be out there, when you're going to be there, and what the limit of the work is going to be. I don't think this policy means that at 5 o'clock every morning, somebody's got to be out there sanding the roads. And even if it does mean that, It says that you continue sanding operations until either the highways are in a condition such that traffic is moving safely or conditions become too hazardous. Now, I don't think the too hazardous part of this is at issue here, but the evidence is that Mr. Bulci, Mr. Prehein, and his underling, Mr. Van Meteren, had started this sanding operation using the maintainer and the grader about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, 3:30 in the afternoon, on the afternoon of the 20th. And continued until 7:30 or 8 o'clock that night.
But this policy specifically required commencement of sanding at 5 a.m. Now, Mr. Schaefer makes an argument that the sequencing language makes that discretionary. How do you respond to that?
The
sequencing. I mean, he argues that the sequencing does not apply to the 5 a.m. requirement. Sequencing is more which highway gets it first and which highway gets it second, and the order in which things happen, not the commencement time of 5 a.m.
Well, I don't think the policy says, Your Honor, that you have to start at 5 a.m. I mean, it says that during the period between 5 a.m. and 7 p.m. you continue sanding. It doesn't say you have to be out there at 5 a.m., and certainly 8 o'clock in the morning is between 5 a.m. and 7 p.m. Now, secondly, I would argue that the limits of work language in paragraph 3 is the language that gives some discretion here. Different roads and different conditions and different types of storms are all going to call for different actions. And that's what Mr. Bulci is paid to do, and that's what he did in this particular case. They were out there, the testimony is that he was out there, I think, until about 7:30 or 8 o'clock, or at some point in time during that late afternoon, early evening, following behind Mr. Preheim and Mr. Van Meteren. Mr. Preheim out with the maintainer, Mr. Van Meteren out with the sander, and Mr. Bulci behind in the truck. And that at 8 o'clock or thereabouts, he determined, in his discretion, using his judgment as the highway maintenance supervisor, that this thing had been sanded out and there was nothing further that could be done at that point, and to go home and to come back at 8 o'clock the next morning, which is what happened. And I think that's clearly a discretionary action. I would also point out that the contract between the state and Mr. Preheim also, and this is what Judge Severson picked up on, the contract on sheet number 6 of 8 provides that the supervisor, who in this case would have been Mr. Bulci, can suspend snow and ice control operations at any time it is felt that continued operation is ineffective or unsafe. And Judge Severson lopped onto that and found that to further create discretion in how this process is to be undertaken.
Did Mr. Bulci decide that it was ineffective or unsafe in this case?
His testimony was that it was by 8 o'clock at that point in time, there was nothing more that could be done. It had been sanded out. I think he did. It was basically ineffective. I mean, it wasn't going to do any good. The temperatures were too cold to continue trying to scrape it off with this big road grader. And at that point, go home. There's nothing more we can do.
How do we as a court deal with this problem of the conflict in the affidavits and the fact over the issue of whether there really was adequate sand out there that morning? How should that fit into our analysis of the sovereign immunity question?
This court...
Excuse me, I don't mean to interrupt, but in fact, the affidavits go beyond that and say that there was no sand there the night before. Don't they?
Well, I don't... my understanding of what the claim here, it's never been a claim that we didn't do anything. It was more a claim of, is what we did effective or not?
But I'm looking
and we did something. We were
looking at it. I'm looking at it from more of an academic point of view. When we have a conflict in the facts over such a critical issue that really has a lot to do with whether or not it's a discretionary or ministerial function, how should we as a court resolve that? When we have a really serious issue of disputed fact.
Well, I think you're charged with reviewing the record de novo. The cases that have been cited in the brief talk about, of course, this is basically still a summary judgment type standard. And you have to give the benefit of the doubt to the non-moving party. I guess where I would disagree with you, Your Honor, is I don't know if this is critical to the issue of whether this is discretionary or ministerial. I mean, the fact of the matter is that starting shortly after the storm up until about 7:30, 8 o'clock on the night of the 20th, there were vehicles out on these roads that were sanding and they were plowing. And Mr. Bulci made the call at that point in time using his judgment and discretion, which is what he's charged to do, to send these guys home. There was nothing more that could be done, and to come back at 8 o'clock.
And that part is undisputed. The fact that they were out there, no one disputes that.
I don't believe anybody disputes that. Now, there may be a dispute as to whether or not there was enough sand on the road,
But I don't think anybody disputes the fact that these guys were out there doing what they could do. And as Mr. Schaefer pointed out, I mean, this was a very difficult storm, and I don't think that's disputed at all either. I mean, you had rain and freezing rain and snow on top of it and cars packing down these roads and so on and so forth. I don't know if that answers your question, Your Honor. I don't know that it gets to the issue, and I still think that this is a discretionary act. Because as Justice Konenkamp pointed out, I mean, there is no dispute that people were out there. It's a question of whether or not, you know, and the beauty's in the eye of the beholder. What you think is a slippery road, I may not think is a slippery road. Mr. Bolte may not think is a slippery road. You know, they were out there and he made the decision. Come back at 8 o'clock.
But is there a problem when the disputed fact is there was no sand out there? I mean, there's nobody testifying that your people are lying that they about whether or not they were out there. But they're saying that through the course of the night, there was no sand out there. It was a dangerous, hazardous condition. So that's a different thing, isn't it? Because if all the sand's blowing off, isn't there some obligation on somebody's part to get back out there, check and see if it stays? Check and see if it's really true, that there's nothing else to be done?
Well, and this gets to another, I think, disputed fact, but the testimony from Mr. Preheim was, of course, he drives this section of road back and forth between his shop and home, and his testimony was that he had driven by it at about 6 o'clock, I think, in the morning, and it was adequately sanded.
I know, but that's self-serving testimony, and you're supposed to take the evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, and that's someone other than Mr. Preheim.
My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Tobin, you have 5 minutes, sir.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Matt Tobin, and our office represents Catherine and Joanna Westfall in what was the first of the two cases, and I understand it's a bit complicated. The issue, obviously, is whether our case should be consolidated with Mr. Schaefer's case, where he represents Mr. Wolf for the death of his son, Landon, in connection with this automobile accident. What Mr. Schaefer doesn't do is go through either the statutory language or the historical prerequisites for consolidation, the first of which was same or similar parties. That language is obviously no longer in the current statute. It was in the old statute. It was referenced in the old cases. But I think most importantly, this court acknowledged in 1992, even under the new statute, that it was appropriate for the trial court to deny a motion to consolidate because, among other reasons, the two actions did not involve the same parties. That's an important fact here because the Westfall action is a claim on behalf of Joanna and Catherine Westfall against Myra Wolf and Farmers Insurance for the alleged negligence of the unidentified driver. The Westfalls are not a party in Mr. Wolf's claim, the second case.
Farmers. The third party action in both of them makes them the same identical claims, don't they?
To a limited extent, the action of Myra Wolf against the state and Preheim and the action of Mr. Wolf against the state and Preheim are similar. Although I do, as we move on to the legal issue argument, those cases do raise some different issues. Further, the second case then has a third party claim brought by the state against Myra Wolf. And that claim, that third party twist, is not present, does not exist in the original Westfall case. So I think as an initial matter, the court should look at the parties and then conclude that the parties are not similar. They're not the same. And consequently, because you have different parties, you're going to have different issues, which then really brings us to the second factor, which is that which was recognized by the statute under Section 42A, in that when an action involves common questions of fact or law. But interestingly, that statute says when the two actions involve a similar question of fact or law, the court may join the two actions. The statute does not require that the trial judge join the two actions. The statute itself grants the trial judge discretion to determine whether the two cases should be joined, even when that condition is met. Here, that condition is not met. The issues in the Westfall case are significantly different. As you would imagine, the jury will have to determine the negligence of Ms. Wolf. The jury will have to determine the negligence of the unidentified driver, whether the combined negligence of Ms. Wolf and the unidentified driver was the legal cause of the Westfall injuries. Then the jury would have to apportion fault between those two tortfeasors. That whole analysis is absent in the second case.
If instead of the Westfalls bringing the action in the beginning, if Myra Wolf, who's obviously going to be a defendant, if she had brought the action for her own injuries and for the injuries of her son, Landon, against and included the Westfalls in there, whatever, and included Farmers Insurance Exchange for being representing an uninsured motorist, and then against Jeff Sense, Marvin Bulci, Preheims, there's no question. Everything that happens here and everything that's going to be tried arises out of one specific set of facts, doesn't it? Correct. And isn't it all really the same lawsuit, just the same as many other cases that have multiple claims and counterclaims and offsetting claims?
Well, I agree, Justice Sabers, that it's the same in an academic or an analytical sense, but in reality they're very much different, and that's why when you get beyond even the same legal issue, you get to prejudice, and there are some checks and balances to make sure that each party's rights are protected. And as we mentioned briefly, there's a very high risk of prejudice here to the Westfalls, and they have a right to bring their claim.
Tell me what that is.
May I go on? Proceed. The risk is obviously the Westfalls have a valid claim against Myra Wolf for losing control of her vehicle and sliding broadside into the Westfall vehicle. Then for Ms. Wolf to inject the issue of her son's death into that case, I think is very prejudicial. As we've argued in the brief, the tragic death of one son is a very emotional issue, and that's one that I don't think that you can separate out when you're determining issues of negligence and causation and then damages. And I don't believe that the Westfalls are in no way responsible for the unfortunate death of Landon.
You don't have any faith that the jury, under proper instructions, providing for favoritism or prejudice or whatever, are smart enough to make that decision, even though we ask them to do that almost every day of their life?
Well, I do believe that juries are very smart, and I do think that they try to follow the law, but jurors are also human beings, and they have emotions, and I just think it would be very difficult to separate the emotion, which you do raise the other issue, and that's instructing the jury in this case, if it was consolidated, I believe would be a nightmare, would make it very difficult to instruct on Kathy and Joanna Westfall's claims, and then Myra Wolf, and then Landon Wolf, and contribution, and third party. I think it's going to be difficult enough.
Okay. I think you've answered the question in
Thank
your
you.
Time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Tobin.
Mr. Schaefer.
Thank you.
Just to address the consolidation issue first, I think Justice Sabers is absolutely right. Courts deal with these issues all the time. There's all kinds of cases where there's counterclaims, cross-claims, and we rely on the jury instructions and resolving those, and the jury is going to be given instructions that their verdict isn't to be based upon sympathy or prejudice or any of those factors. So I think those issues can be handled, and the statute for consolidation doesn't require the parties to be the same. In fact, the Engelman case involved three different plaintiffs, and the court consolidated against one defendant. The court consolidated it, and said it was, and this court upheld it and said it was properly consolidated.
How did the trial court judge abuse his discretion in ruling on this decision?
I think the court abused its discretion in the sense that the purpose of the rule is to further judicial economy. We're going to have essentially now two separate trials. It's going to require all of the same evidence. It's going to require, the evidence is going to be the same in both cases. I mean, between Senst, Bolche, Preheim, Mrs. Wolf, this phantom driver, I mean, that all that evidence is going to come in both cases, and to require two separate trials is going to require a duplication. It isn't conducive to judicial economy, and furthermore, it creates a potential for inconsistent verdicts.
But isn't a trial judge, within his or her abuse of discretion standard, supposed to weigh those two considerations against prejudice?
Right, and in this case, the two things that the judge relied on, which I think were incorrect, was the fact that they were different parties, and because of the death of Landon. Those are the two things that the trial judge pointed out as the basis for his decision, and those are, I think, not proper factors to consider for that.
Will the death of Landon come in that Westfall case?
Well, I think it will. I mean, he's, how do you explain it? Here's an 11-year-old kid that's not around to testify. I mean, he's a potential witness to the case. Where is this? Where is he? I think it would come in. It's part of the entire facts of the case. Now, I wanted to answer...
Haven't you kind of tried to doctor that issue a little bit? By instead of having Myra bring the suit for her son, you're grabbing the husband, and he's bringing.
I didn't start this lawsuit.
I know you didn't.
But the fact of the matter is, and there's a good reason for that, and it's because there's an old South Dakota Supreme Court case, Tufte versus Sioux Falls Transit, that involved a similar situation. The question was, is the mother's contributory negligence barred the wrongful death claim of the father in a situation like that, and this court said no, it doesn't. So whoever brought that, it wasn't me, had a good reason to do it. I did want to answer Judge Rush's question about the certificate of insurance. This certificate lapsed in like November or December before this real snow removal season took place, and the reason Mr. Preheim didn't purchase it is because he said he let it lapse because he said he couldn't afford to pay the premium. With respect to the argument that this section about change in sequence rates or limits of work authorized discretion to Mr. Senst or Mr. Bolche, there's absolutely no evidence that the region engineer, Tom Week, delegated any of that. And furthermore...
Isn't there evidence by the fact they're simply doing it? Don't the facts speak for themselves? That Senst and Bolche are out there supervising the operation. There's no reading from the briefs that Tom was involved.
Right. Weeks isn't involved, but it's up to him to make that decision. Unless...
Once again, the fact that they're doing it, what evidence do you have they're not doing it?
I mean, they claim that they're doing it, but the other reason it doesn't make any sense is it talks about sequence rates or limits of work. It does not talk about time of when sanding is to begin. It doesn't mention time.
What does limits of work mean?
The only thing that makes any sense, Judge, is this sanding policy talks about the sequence, and it talks about the priority routes. It talks about rates, which is the sanding, and limits of work. The only thing that makes any sense is it talks about the rates per mile of sand and salt to be applied. If they meant the time when sanding is to begin, it would have been written in there. And furthermore, it all precedes this section that says that the sanding is to continue between 5 a.m. and 7 p.m. Now, there's no evidence. They argue it was ineffective, and that's what the trial judge latched on to, that the sanding was ineffective. That's not their claim. Their claim was it was sanded out, and it does bring back this fact question. There's a dispute as to what the true facts were. Was it really sanded out? Because the affidavit of Mr. McLean says it wasn't the night before, and certainly it wasn't that morning. So if their discretion is based on this, the procedure that says during the period between 5 a.m. and 7 p.m., continue sanding operations until either the highways are in a condition such that traffic is moving safely or conditions become too hazardous for continued operation. If they're relying on the exception there that it was safe, then there is a big fact question. And maybe it is a jury question on that, if that's what they latch on to. But I would submit that this isn't, I looked at those social work cases, and I've been up here in those social work cases where this court has held that social workers perform ministerial functions. And I lost those cases when I argue that they're exercising discretion. But this court said they are governed by some standards. But you look at the standards, and the standards are very similar to what governs these people. If this court is going to adopt a policy that says Merv Bolche and Jeff Sense are engaged in discretionary functions, then I would submit that most of the state employees will be immune from suit.
That leads me to a question that's kind of disturbing me, and maybe you can help me here. If we accept your theory that this is purely ministerial, South Dakota can be a hazardous place to drive in the winter. Are we opening the door wide to a lawsuit against some highway worker every time somebody slides off the road and is in an accident?
I don't think so.
Should we concern ourselves with that?
No, I don't think that's the argument that they raise, and it does raise a legitimate question. But this is not a case where we're talking about an accident in an isolated area. Everybody knew. Mr. Preheim knew, Mr. Sense knew, Mr. Bolche knew that this was an extremely bad spot. They all admitted it. They said this is one of the most treacherous areas on that stretch of road.
What does that have to do with whether it's discretionary or ministerial?
Well, it has to do with the issue we're not opening the door to every accident that occurs in the state. But I would submit that the policy, the purpose of discretionary versus ministerial is to protect the policymakers, people that are charged with making the policy, probably the people that adopt this policy, but not the people that carry it out, not the people that enforce it. It's no different. This court has said that the drivers, we don't have rules that govern state employees when they're driving, but if they're negligent, that's a ministerial function. The janitor that is responsible for mopping the hallways, or his supervisor, I'm assuming that's a ministerial function.
Is that why Tom Waite's not a party to this action? Because he is?
Well, I think that the higher up you get, in all the cases, if you look at it, the higher up you get, this court has said, once you get into that policy-making area, those people are in the ministerial functions. The people that we brought in were the people that were charged with supervising the contractor, Mr. Preheim, in this case. But the court this is going to set a precedent in the state. Are we going to say all state employees that exercise some discretion in the performance of their job are immune?
So you're saying that sovereign immunity should not apply because they were not of the governmental policymaking level that would exclude them, so then their actions should just be judged on a negligence basis for which the people insurance would protect them.
I agree with that. And the other reason that makes sense is it's similar to the case I said, the Bryant versus Butte County case. This court said there that maintenance of secondary roads is a purely ministerial function. And I don't think primary roads are any different.
Should Bryant, a political subdivision sovereign immunity case, apply to the state of South Dakota?
The court used the same analysis in Bryant. In fact, they used that seven-factor test. And I think a county is an arm of the state, so I think the same analysis probably applies.
There is a there are a lot of distinguishing.
I understand that, but I know cities are different. But I think counties are considered arms of the state, and clearly the court in Bryant followed that seven-factor analysis, which is the same analysis that's applied in the other cases. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.